Chapter 3. At this very same hour, in the downstairs apartment belonging to the owner of the house, the engineer Vasily Ivanovich Lisovich, there was total silence, broken only by the occasional sound of a mouse in the small dining room. The mouse was busily and doggedly gnawing away at a piece of old cheese in the sideboard, cursing the miserliness of the engineer's wife, Vanda Mikhailovna. The object of the mouse's curse, the bony and jealous Vanda, was fast asleep in the dark bedroom of the damp, cool apartment. The engineer himself was awake in his cramped little study, hung with curtains and stuffed with books, which gave the room a remarkably cozy feel. A standard lamp in the form of an Egyptian princess, topped by a green, florid, umbrella-shaped lampshade, filled the entire room with a soft, mysterious light, a mysteriousness that was shared by the engineer himself, sitting in his deep leather armchair. The mystery and ambiguity of the uncertain times in which they lived was above all reflected in the fact that the person in the armchair wasn't Vasily Ivanovich Lisovich at all, but simply Vasilisa. He called himself Lisovich, it is true, and many of those he came across called him Vasily Ivanovich, but this was only to his face. Behind his back, everyone just referred to him as Vasilisa. The reason for this was that ever since the beginning of the truly unusual events in the city in January 1918, he had become afraid that he might be held responsible for something or other in the future. Instead, therefore, of neatly appending his usual name of V. Lisovich on questionnaires, forms, certificates, orders, and ration cards, he had started writing Vas Lis. On the 18th of January 1918, Nikolka had been queuing for sugar on the Kreschatik with a ration card given to him by Vasily Ivanovich, when, instead of getting any sugar, he had been struck with terrible force in the back by a stone and had spent the next 2 days spitting blood. A shell had burst right over the heads of the people who had been bravely standing in the sugar queue. Back home, although green in the face and clutching at the wall, he even managed a smile so as not to alarm Yelena. But when he spat up a whole basin full of blood, she cried out in horror, "My God, what's happened?" "It's all Vasilisa's fault, damn him, him and his sugar," Nikolka replied. Then he turned white and collapsed onto his side. He was on his feet again within 2 days, but by this time Vasily Ivanovich Lisovich was no more. At first, it was only his immediate neighbors, but later the whole city began to refer to the engineer as Vasilisa, with the exception of his wife, who continued to introduce him as chairman of the housing committee, Lisovich. Once he was sure that it had become totally quiet outside, with not even the occasional swish of a sledge going by, and that from the whistling sound coming from the bedroom, his wife was still soundly asleep, Vasilisa went out to the hallway and carefully checked that the bolts, lock, latch, and chain were secure, and then returned to his little study. He took out 4 safety pins from the drawer of his massive desk, placing them on top. Then he tiptoed somewhere into the darkness and returned, carrying a sheet and a rug. Once again, he stood for a moment, listening carefully, and even put his finger to his lips. He took off his jacket, rolled up his sleeves, and reached up to the shelf for a pot of glue, a neat roll of wallpaper, and a pair of scissors. Then he pressed his face close to the window and, shielding his face with the palm of his hand, looked out onto the street. He hung up the sheet over the bottom half of the window on the left-hand side, then attached the rug to the other window with the safety pins. He carefully arranged the sheet and the rug so that no chinks were visible. Then he climbed on a chair, and groping around for something above the topmost bookshelf, he took a knife and made a vertical cut in the wallpaper, followed by another at right angles to the first. Inserting the knife under the slit, he uncovered a neat little hidey hole, 2 bricks wide, which he himself had made the previous evening. He removed the thin zinc cover and placed it to one side. He then got down from the chair, glanced apprehensively at the windows, and checked the sheet once more. With 2 jingling turns of the key, he then opened the lower drawer of his desk, to reveal to God's world at the very bottom of the drawer a sealed packet covered in newspaper, neatly tied both ways. He buried the packet in the hidey hole and replaced the cover. He then spent a long time measuring and cutting out strips of wallpaper on the red tablecloth until he was certain they were the right size. He glued the strips over the slit so expertly and managed to match the little squares and flower patterns so precisely that he was delighted with the result. When the engineer finally got down from the chair, he was satisfied that the hidey hole was completely invisible. He rubbed his hands in glee, scrunched up the wallpaper cuttings, and burned them in the stove. Then he stirred the ashes and hid the glue. Outside, in the dark and empty street, a grey, unkempt lupine figure climbed silently down from the acacia branch on which he had been sitting for the last 30 minutes. Although frozen to the bone, he had eagerly been observing all that the engineer had been doing through a giveaway gap at the very top of the sheet. It had been the contrast between the white sheet and the green-painted window frame that had first fatally attracted the stranger's attention. Springing lightly down into a snowdrift, he went on up the street and then continued making his way down alleyways, all traces of him being swallowed up and obliterated by the blizzard, the dark, and the snow. Nighttime. Vasilisa, in his armchair under the green lampshade, looking the very image of Taras Bulba. Drooping, bushy moustache. By God, this isn't Vasilisa, but a real man. There's another gentle jingle of keys in the drawer, and a wad of oblong notes designed like green playing cards appears on the red tablecloth in front of him. The notes bear the following legend, in Ukrainian. State Bank Certificate, 50 karbovansi, parity with all credit notes. The front of the notes depicted a peasant with a drooping moustache armed with a spade, together with a peasant woman carrying a sickle. The reverse side featured the same couple, their reddish faces magnified within an oval frame, the man sporting the same drooping moustache in the Ukrainian style. The top of the note carried the warning, "The penalty for forgery is imprisonment." Signed, Lyebed Yurchik, director of the State Bank. A bronze Alexander II on horseback, sporting a ragged metal foam of side whiskers on either side of his face, looked irritably down at Lyebed Yurchik's work of art, and, more indulgently, at the Egyptian princess on her lamp. On the wall, an official with the Order of St. Stanislav round his neck, an oil painting of one of Vasilisa's ancestors, stared in horror at the notes. The spines of books by Goncharov and Dostoevsky glowed softly in the green lamplight, and the gold and black row of Brockhaus and Ephron stood to attention like guards on parade. Domestic bliss. Safely tucked away in the cash in the wall were 5% bonds, together with 1,500 rubles from the time of Catherine the Great, 900 Peter the Great rubles, 1,000 Nicholas the First rubles, 3 diamond rings, 1 brooch, 1 Order of Anna, and 2 Orders of St. Stanislav. In cash number 2 were another 2,000 Catherine rubles, another 1,000 Peter rubles, 25 silver spoons, a gold watch and chain, 3 cigarette cases, inscribed to our dear colleague, although Vasilisa was a non-smoker, 50 10-ruble gold coins, salt cellars, a canteen of silver cutlery for 6 people, and a silver tea strainer. This large cash was to be found in the woodshed. From the doorway, take 2 steps forward, 1 to the left, and then 1 more step from the chalk mark on a plank in the wall. Everything was in Einem biscuit boxes, wrapped in oilcloth with tarred seams and buried to a depth of nearly 5 feet. There was a third cache to be found in the attic, hidden in clay under a beam and reached by taking 2 quarter steps in a northeasterly direction from the chimney stack. Here there were the sugar tongs, another 183 10-ruble gold coins, and bonds to the value of 25,000 rubles. The Lyebed Yurchik was for current expenses. Vasilisa glanced round as he always did when counting money, licked his finger, and started to check the Ukrainian notes. He had an inspired expression on his face. Then he suddenly went pale.
"That one's a forgery, and so's this," he growled angrily, shaking his head. "This is a disaster."
Vasilisa's blue eyes darkened murderously. One of the notes in the third batch of 10 was forged, 2 more in the 4th and 6th batches, and in the 9th batch there were 3 notes in a row for which Lyebed Yurchik would indubitably threaten imprisonment. Out of a total of 130 notes, 8, if you please, looked clearly to be forgeries. The peasant had a sullen expression when he should have been looking jolly. The hidden quotation marks and colon next to the sheaf were missing, and the paper was of a better quality than Liebid's. When Vasilisa held one note up to the light, the watermark of Liebid's portrait clearly showed through on the wrong side.
"Right, one of these will be for the cabby tomorrow evening," he said to himself. "I'll have to take a cab anyway, and then there's also the market."
Carefully setting the forged notes intended for the cabby and the market to one side, he locked the bundle of money away with a jingle of keys. He jumped as the deathly silence was broken by the sound of someone running in the room above, and he could hear laughter and muffled voices.
"There you are, you see," he said, addressing Alexander II. "Never any peace."
Everything went quiet again. Vasilisa yawned, stroked his bristly moustache, took the sheet and the rug down from the window, and switched on the small lamp in the sitting room. There was a faint gleam of light from the gramophone loudspeaker. 10 minutes later, and the apartment was completely dark. Vasilisa was asleep next to his wife in the damp bedroom. There was a smell of mice, mould, and querulous boredom. And Vasilisa dreamt that Liebed Yurchik arrived at the house on horseback, accompanied by thieves who opened up the cash with screwdrivers. Then the knave of hearts climbed up on the chair, spat at his moustache, and shot at him point blank. Vasilisa leapt up with a yell, bathed in cold sweat. The first thing he heard was the family of mice in the dining room, gnawing away at a bag of biscuits. Then the sound of laughter and the strumming of a guitar that was being played with unusual tenderness, coming through the ceiling and the carpeted room above. Then, in the room above, a voice started singing with extraordinary power and passion, and the guitar struck up a march.
"There's nothing for it. I'll have to kick them out," said Vasilisa, tossing and turning in bed. "This is torture. No peace day or night."
The cadets are singing as they march along, with their arms a-swinging as they march along.
"And yet, maybe, just in case, after all these are terrible times, and you never know who you might have in their place, as officers they would be some sort of protection if anything happened." "Scram!" he shouted at the enraged mouse.
And the guitar played on and on. Four lights burning in the chandelier in the dining room. Wreaths of blue smoke. The glass doors onto the veranda hidden behind cream-coloured curtains. The clocks are inaudible. Fresh vases of hothouse roses against the whiteness of the tablecloth. 3 bottles of vodka and some slender bottles of German white wine. Lafitte wine glasses, apples in gleaming cut-glass vases, slices of lemon, crumbs all over the table. Tea. A crumpled page from the humorous newspaper, The Devil's Plaything, on an armchair. Minds clouded by the fog of uncertainty, with thoughts now rising to sunlit uplands of irrational joy, now plunging into dark valleys of anxiety. Random sentences and snippets of nonsense verse floated around in the fog. "Best not sit on a hedgehog without any clothes."
"Load of old nonsense, but at least the guns have stopped. What a laugh, damn it. Vodka, vodka, my mind's gone blank. Come on, how about a twang on the guitar?"
No point in baking melons on a bar of soap. The Americans have won, so don't lose hope. Hidden behind a wall of smoke, Mishlaevsky, now quite drunk, roared with laughter. "Breitman's wit is pretty good, as everyone knows. But where are the Senegalese, do you suppose?"
"Yes, right. Where are they? Where are they?"
asked Mishlaevsky, slurring his words.
"Sheep give birth when they're in a tent, and Rodzianko'll be our president."
"But they're talented, those bastards. You have to give them that."
Presiding over all of this was Yelena, sitting in an armchair at the narrow end of the table. Since Talberg's departure, she had not been allowed to have a moment to herself, and white wine does not take the pain away completely. It merely blunts it. Opposite her, at the other end of the table, sat Mishlaevsky in a dressing gown, unshaven, white-faced, covered in blotches from the vodka and devastating fatigue. His eyes were ringed with red from the extreme cold, the shock of events, the vodka and anger. Alexei and Nikolka were sitting along one side of the table. Opposite them sat Leonid Yuryevich Shavinsky, former hussar lieutenant in the Life Guards and now adjutant on the headquarters staff of Prince Bielorukov. Next to him was second lieutenant Fyodor Nikolaevich Stepanov of the artillery, universally known since his grammar school days as Karas, or Carp. Karas, small, compact, and indeed looking extraordinarily like a carp, had bumped into Shavinsky right at the entrance to the turbines some 20 minutes after Tolberg had left. Both turned out to have bottles on them. Shavinsky, a package of 4 bottles of white wine, Karas, 2 bottles of vodka. In addition, Shavinsky was laden with the largest imaginable bouquet of flowers hidden in 3 layers of wrapping paper. Roses, for Yelena Vasilyevna, of course. Standing by the entrance, Karas lost no time in telling Shavinsky about the gold artillery insignia on his epaulette. He had run out of patience, he said. Everybody would be needed to go and fight. In any case, what they had been taught at college would be irrelevant, particularly if Petlura were to enter the city. Everybody had a duty to fight, and all artillerymen had to join the mortar battalion. The commanding officer was Colonel Malyshev, and the battalion itself was a remarkable one, full of students from his college. But the fact that Mishlaevsky had gone off to join that idiotic detachment filled him with despair. Goodness knows where he was now. He'd probably gone and got himself killed somewhere near the city. But when they got upstairs, who should be there but Mishlaevsky? In the semi-gloom of her bedroom, golden Yelena hastily powdered her face in the oval, silver-leafed mirror and went out to receive the roses. Wonderful! Everybody was there. Compared with Shavinsky's pale-colored cavalry epaulettes and immaculately pressed blue breeches, Karas's crumpled artillery insignia looked far less resplendent. Shavinsky's eyes danced with malicious glee when he was told about Tolberg's disappearance. The little hussar immediately sensed that he was in exceptionally fine voice, and in the pink glow of the lamplight, the sitting room became filled with an overwhelming cascade of sound as he sang a hymn of praise to the god of marriage. He sang with such power and passion that you might be forgiven for thinking that a voice such as Shavinsky's was the only thing on earth that made any sense. For the time being, of course, there was his staff job and this idiotic war, and besides, the Bolsheviks and Petlura had to be confronted as well, not to mention his duty. But afterwards, when everything had returned to normal, despite his St. Petersburg connections, and what connections they were, too, he would give up his military career and go on the stage. He would sing at La Scala and at the Bolshoi in Moscow while the Bolsheviks were being hanged on lampposts on Theatre Square. When in Zhmerinka he had sung an A rather than an F during a rendition of the Epithalamium, Countess Lendrikova had fallen in love with him, and he had held the A for 5 bars. At this, Shavinsky hung his head a little and looked round the room as if he had been telling someone else's story rather than his own.
That's right, for 5 bars. All right, let's go and eat.
And so the wreaths of cigarette smoke.
Well, where are the Senegalese troops, then? Come on, staff officer, let's have an answer. Leonochka, my beautiful golden girl, have some more wine. Everything will work out. Leaving when he did was the best thing he could have done. He'll make his way to the Don, and then he'll be back here with Denikin's army.
They'll come, boomed Shavinsky. They'll come, I'm certain of it. And now, if I may, some important news. I saw Serbian billet officers today on the Krestchatik. The day after tomorrow, in 2 days' time at the latest, 2 Serbian regiments will be arriving in the city.
Really? Is that true?
Shavinsky frowned.
That's a little strange. If I say I saw it, then such a question seems out of place.
2 regiments, you say? 2 regiments?
All right, then, be so kind as to listen to this. The prince himself told me today that troop transports with Greeks and 2 divisions of Senegalese on board are already being unloaded in Odessa. We just need to hold out for 1 more week, and then we can tell the Germans to go to hell.
Traitors!
Well, if all that's true, then we'll catch Petlura and string him up. String him up! I'll shoot him myself. Another drop, gentlemen. Your good health.
Suddenly, the fog takes over completely.
fog, ladies and gentlemen. Having drunk 3 glasses of wine, Nikolka dashed to his room for a handkerchief. Running through the hallway, he crashed against the coat stand. You can always be yourself when you know no one's watching. Shavinsky's curved saber, with its gleaming gold hilt, the gift of some Persian prince, a Damascene sword. Actually, it hadn't been a gift from a prince, and the sword wasn't from Damascus, although it was certainly an expensive and fine-looking blade. A grim-looking Mauser on a strap in its holster. Karas's stare automatic pistol, with its burnished muzzle. Nikolka grasped covetously at the cold wooden holster, and running his fingers over the Mauser's lethal barrel, almost wept from excitement. He wanted to leave immediately and fight in the snow-covered fields around Postvolinsky. He felt ashamed and awkward. Here he was in a warm room with plenty of vodka, but out there it was dark, a blizzard was blowing, and the cadets were freezing to death. What were those staff officers thinking of? The unit was unprepared, the students untrained, and the Senegalese still hadn't come. Almost certainly as black as boots, they'd freeze to death here, wouldn't they, for heaven's sake? They were used to a warm climate, weren't they? Well, I'd string up your hetman first, shouted Alexei. For the last 6 months, he's just been laughing at all of us. Who was it against the idea of a Russian army being formed? The hetman. And now, when things have got really bad and the enemy is at the gates, they've started to form a Russian army. But it's simply staff officers and a few independent units. What do you think of that, eh? You're just panic-mongering. Me? Panic-mongering? Why do you simply refuse to understand me? I'm not panic-mongering at all. I just want to get everything that's been boiling up inside me off my chest. Panic-mongering. Don't worry, I've already decided to go to that battalion tomorrow. And if your Malyshev doesn't want to take me as a doctor, then I'll enlist as an ordinary private. I'm so fed up with all this. I'm not panicking. A piece of cucumber stuck in Alexei's throat, and he started coughing and choking. Nikolka began to thump him on the back. Right, agreed Karas, banging the table. Private, you say? Nonsense. We'll get you in as a doctor. We'll all go tomorrow, together, Mishlaevsky mumbled drunkenly. All of us, together. The entire Alexandrovsky Imperial High School. Hurrah! He's an absolute swine, Alexei continued scathingly. He doesn't even speak our language. What do you think of that? 2 days ago, I was talking to that swine Dr. Koritsky. Apparently, since last November, he's forgotten how to speak Russian. He's even changed his surname so that it's Ukrainian rather than Russian. Anyway, when I ask him what cat is in Ukrainian, he replies, kit. But since kit means whale in Russian, I ask him what whale is in Ukrainian. He pauses, stares at me for a moment and says nothing, and now he won't even acknowledge me. Nikolka roared with laughter. It's not at all surprising there isn't a word for whale, because they don't have them in the Ukraine, whereas Russia has masses of them, in the White Sea, for example. As for mobilization, Alexei continued venomously, it's a pity you didn't see what was going on in the police stations yesterday. Every one of those currency speculators knew about the order to mobilize 3 days before it was given. How about that? And they all either had a hernia or some patch on their lung, or they'd simply vanished into thin air. And that, my friends, is a very ominous sign. If you have people gossiping in the coffee houses just before mobilization is announced, and then nobody joins up, things are in a very bad way. The bastards. The absolute bastards. If only he'd started forming the officer corps in April, we would have taken Moscow by now. You realize he could have formed an army of 50,000 men. And what an army, eh? Picked troops, the very best, as they would all have been officers and cadets, graduates from the training school. There are thousands of such people in the city, and all of them would have joined up with enthusiasm. Not only would we have annihilated Petlura here, but we would have squashed Trotsky like a fly in Moscow. And precisely now would have been the right time to attack. They say they've started eating cats there. The hetman would have saved Russia. The son of a bitch. Alexei's face was covered in red blotches, and the words were gushing out of his mouth, accompanied by thin streams of saliva. Listen to you. You should have been Minister of Defense rather than a doctor, said Karas. He smiled ironically, but he had liked and been inspired by what Turbin had said. Alexei's your man at any meeting, said Nikolka. He's an orator. Nikolka, I've told you more than once that your so-called witticisms are not very funny, Alexei said. Have some more wine instead.
But you realize that the Germans wouldn't allow an army to be formed, said Karas. They'd be afraid of it.
That's not true, Alexei exclaimed in a thin voice. It just needed someone with a head on his shoulders to come to some sort of an arrangement with the Hetman, and then it would only have been necessary to explain to the Germans that we weren't any threat to them. It's over. We've lost the war. But we are faced with something else, something that's even more terrible than war or anything else. Trotsky. This is what we should have said to the Germans. You need sugar and bread, don't you? All right. Take whatever you need to feed your troops. Exploit us if you want, but help us and let us form an army. You must know that it will be to your own benefit. We'll help you keep order in the Ukraine to ensure that our Ukrainian holy men don't get infected with the Moscow disease. And with a Russian army in the city, we'd be protected from Moscow by a wall of steel. And as for Petliura, tchah. Turbin drew his finger across his throat and broke into a violent coughing fit. Hold on a moment, said Chavinsky, standing up. I've got to speak up in the Hetman's defense. There have been mistakes, it's true, but his plan was a sound one. He's a diplomat, all right. First a Ukrainian state, to be sure, but then he would have done exactly as you've been saying. There would have been a Russian army, no argument about it. How do you like that? Chavinsky gestured solemnly in the vague direction of the city. The Russian tricolor is already flying on Vladimirskaya Street. They've taken their time about it. Yes, it is a bit late, it's true, but the prince is sure the mistake can be corrected. Well, I hope to God he's right. Alexei turned to the icon of the Virgin Mary in the corner and crossed himself. The plan was as follows, Chavinsky declaimed solemnly. As soon as the war was over, the Germans would have reorganized in order to assist us in the struggle against the Bolsheviks. And then, once Moscow was occupied, the Hetman would have laid the Ukraine at the feet of His Imperial Majesty Tsar Nikolai Alexandrovich. This utterance was met by the silence of the grave. Nikolka's face turned pale from grief. The Tsar is dead, he whispered. What? You mean Nikolai Alexandrovich? Alexei asked, stunned, while Myshlaevsky, reeling from the news, looked askance at his neighbor's glass. Chavinsky had clearly had too much to drink, and was now too drunk to talk any sense. Yelena, her head in her hands, looked up at the hussar officer in horror. But in actual fact, Chavinsky wasn't particularly drunk. He raised his hand and said in a stentorian voice, Not so fast. Just listen. But I would ask you, gentlemen, to keep what I am about to say entirely to yourselves. Nikolka went red in the face. Then he turned pale again. All right, then. Do you know what happened when the Hetman and his entourage were presented to Kaiser Wilhelm?
Not the faintest idea, Karas said, his interest quickening.
Well, I know what happened.
Yes, of course, he knows everything, mocked Myshlaevsky. You should just,
gentlemen, let him speak.
After the Kaiser had graciously spoken to the Hetman and his suite, he said, I will bid you farewell, gentlemen, and now here's someone to talk to you about the future. The curtain across the door swished back, and our Emperor walked into the room. Gentlemen, he said, go to the Ukraine and mobilize your regiments. As soon as the moment arrives, I will personally lead our army into the heart of Russia, into Moscow. And as he said that, his eyes filled with tears. His eyes shining, Chavinsky looked round at the assembled company, downed a whole glass of wine at one gulp, and grimaced. Five pairs of eyes stared back at him. No one made a sound until he had sat down and started eating a piece of ham.
Yes, but that's just a fabrication, said Alexei, screwing his eyes up from the pain of it all. I've heard it before.
They were all killed, Myshlaevsky said. The Tsar, the Tsarina, and the Tsarevich.
Chavinsky glanced at the stove, took a deep breath, and said, If you believe that, you're wrong. The news of His Imperial Majesty's death
is somewhat exaggerated,
interrupted Myshlaevsky with a drunken attempt at a witticism. Yelena, trembling with indignation, rose above the haze of smoke.
You should be ashamed of yourself, Vitya. You're an officer.
Myshlaevsky ducked back into the haze.
The news of His Imperial Majesty's death is a lie, dreamt up by the Bolsheviks themselves. The Tsar managed to escape with the help of his loyal tutor, sorry, I meant to say his son's tutor, Monsieur Zhilya, and a group of officers who spirited him away to, Asia. From there, they made their way to Singapore, and then by sea to Europe. And now the Tsar is the guest of Kaiser Wilhelm.
But they've got rid of him too, haven't they? Karas interposed.
They are both the guests of Denmark, and with them is Her Most August Majesty, the Dowager Empress, Maria Fyodorovna. And if you don't believe me, you should know that I heard all this from the prince himself.
Torn in two by what he had heard, Nikolka groaned inwardly. He wanted to believe it so much.
If that's the case, he said solemnly, suddenly jumping up and wiping the sweat from his brow, I would like to propose a toast to the health of His Imperial Majesty.
His glass flashed, and the golden arrows on its cut glass side pierced the white German wine. Spurs clattered against the chairs. Myshlaevsky stood up, swaying and clutching at the table. Yelena, too, stood up. The golden crescent of her hair had fallen loose and now hung over her temples.
Even if he is dead, I don't mind, she shouted hoarsely, her voice cracking. So what? I'll drink to him all the same.
He will never be forgiven for abdicating at no, never. All the same, bitter experience has taught us that only the monarchy is capable of saving Russia. So even if the Tsar really is dead, long live the Tsar, shouted Alexei, raising his glass. Hurrah! Hurrah! Hurrah!
The dining room resounded with cheers. Down below, Vasilisa leapt up in a cold sweat. Still half asleep, he let out a blood-curdling yell and woke Vanda Mikhailovna.
My God! My God!
Vanda mumbled, clutching at his nightshirt.
What on earth's going on? It's 3 o'clock!
Vasilisa shouted, weeping, addressing the blackened ceiling.
That's it! I shall certainly complain!
Vanda started to whimper. Suddenly, they both froze. A massive, oily wave of sound crashed down on them through the ceiling. Riding the crest of the wave was a rich, powerful baritone voice, ringing out like a bell.
Almighty, all-powerful, reign over us!
Vasilisa's heart missed a beat, and even his feet broke into an excessive sweat. Speaking as if through cotton wool, he muttered,
No, that's too much. They've gone out of their minds. They could cause us so much trouble we'd never get out of it. Everyone knows the national anthem's forbidden. My God, what do they think they're doing? It could be heard outside, for goodness sake.
But Vanda had already collapsed like a stone into sleep again. Vasilisa himself lay down again only when the final chord, accompanied by muffled shouts and cries, had died away.
Russia can be sustained by only two things, the Orthodox faith and autocracy, shouted Myshlaevsky, swaying unsteadily. That's right. A week ago, I was at a performance of Paul the First, Myshlaevsky mumbled, slurring his words, and when the actor declaimed those words, I could not stop myself shouting out my approval. And what do you think? There was applause all round the theatre, except for some swine or other in the upper circle who yelled out, Idiot!
Yids!
Shouted Karas darkly, also the worse for drink.
Fog, fog everywhere. Tonk, tank, tonk, tank.
Senseless to have any more vodka or wine. Hearts are full to overflowing, can take no more. In the narrow little lavatory, the lamp leapt and danced about on the ceiling as if bewitched. Everything became blurred as the room spun round and round. With a pale and tortured expression, Myshlaevsky was violently sick. He was supported by an equally drunk Alexei, looking terrible, his cheeks twitching, his wet hair plastered to his forehead.
Ugh!
Myshlaevsky finally leant back from the bowl with a groan, and, struggling painfully to focus on his surroundings, clung to Alexei like an empty sack.
Nikolka!
Somebody called out through the haze and the dark streaks. It took a few moments for Alexei to realize that it was his own voice he had heard.
Nikolka!
He called out again. The white lavatory wall swayed and turned green.
My God, how disgusting! How revolting!
I swear I'll never again mix vodka with wine. Nicole! Groaned Myshlaevsky hoarsely, slumping onto the floor. A black gap widened to reveal Nikolka's head and chevron.
Nicole, help me. Take him by the arm.
Nikolka made sympathetic noises and, shaking his head, reached laboriously down to help. The body, more dead than alive, slithered around in every direction, the legs jerking about like a puppet on a string, the head lolling inertly on the shoulders. Tonk, tank. The clock jumped off the wall and leapt back again. The flowers danced around in their vases. Yelena's face was blotched, a lock of hair bouncing over her right eyebrow.
Right, put him to bed.
You could at least get him into a dressing gown. It's not very nice for me with him in that state. You damned idiots, you're hopeless when you drink. Vitka, Vitka, what's wrong?
Leave him, Nikolusha. It's no use. Listen, in the cupboard in my room on the shelf, you'll find a little bottle marked liquor ammonia. You'll see it. One of the corners of the label is torn. Smells of ammonia.
Right, I'll get it straight away.
Look at you, and you're a doctor, too.
Yes, yes, all right.
What, isn't there any pulse?
No, it's nothing. He'll get over it.
Basin, quickly.
Here you are.
Oh, look at you.
There was a sudden reek of ammonia. Karas and Yelena held Myshlaevsky's mouth open, while Nikolka supported him, and Alexei twice poured the cloudy white liquid down his throat.
Get some snow, snow! Christ almighty! Have to do it like this, though.
The liquid dripped down from the damp rag covering his forehead. Below the rag, the bloodshot whites of his eyes could be seen rolling around under half-closed eyelids, and his sharp nose was marked by bluish shadows. Jostling each other, the three of them busied themselves over the stricken officer for a quarter of an hour until he opened his eyes.
Go away,
he croaked.
Oh, all right, let him sleep here.
Lights shone in every room as they bustled about the apartment making beds.
Leonid Yuryevich, you can sleep here next to Nikolka.
Right.
Shevinsky, his face a copper red color, but still cheerful, bowed, showing his parting. Yelena's white hands fluttered over the pillows on the settee.
You don't need to do that. Let me.
Go away. Why are you tugging at that pillow? I don't need your help.
Allow me to kiss your hand.
What for?
To thank you for all your trouble.
It can wait. Nikolka, are you in bed? How is he?
Not too bad. He's on the mend. He'll sleep it off.
In the room leading to Nikolka's, two beds had been made up behind two bookcases that had been pulled close together. Both bookcases were full of books. This was the room known in the professor's family as the library. In the library, in Nikolka's room and in the dining room, the lights had gone out. From Yelena's bedroom, a dark red patch of light crept out through the narrow gap in the dining room door. Finding the light tiring, Yelena had thrown a dark red theater bonnet over the lamp on the bedside table. At one time, she used to go to the theater wearing this bonnet, her arms, furs, and lips smelling pleasantly of perfume, and her face delicately powdered. She looked out at the world from under this bonnet, like Liza from the Queen of Spades. But in the course of the past year, the bonnet had rapidly become strangely tatty. The folds had shrunk and faded, and it had lost its ribbons. And, like Liza from the Queen of Spades, golden-haired Yelena sat on the bed in her housecoat, ready for sleep, her hands on her knees, and her bare feet buried in the ancient, worn bearskin rug. Her brief spell of intoxication had completely gone, and her head was enveloped as if by a bonnet of dark, overwhelming grief. From the next room, muffled by the cupboard that had been placed against the door, she could hear Nikolka's gentle whistling and Shervinsky's loud, hearty snoring. From the library, where Karas and the poleaxed Myshlaevsky lay asleep, there was silence. Alone in her room, in the dark red lamplight shining through the bonnet and the windows forming two black holes in the wall, Yelena felt uninhibited, able to talk to herself, now silently and now in an undertone, hardly moving her lips.
He's gone.
Musing and muttering to herself, she screwed up her dry eyes. She couldn't understand her own thoughts. He'd chosen to go at this particular time. But all right, he was a very sensible person,
and by going now he'd done the right thing. It was for the best, wasn't it?
But at such a time, she muttered and sighed deeply. What kind of a man is he?
She loved him, it seemed, and had even become attached to him. And now, sitting there alone in her room with the windows looking like black tombstones, there was this overwhelming sense of grief. And yet at this moment, her heart was not filled with that feeling which is so essential for every marriage, if it is to survive, not even when it is a marriage between beautiful golden-haired Yelena and a cautious, ambitious general staff officer from the Baltic. A marriage with bonnets, perfumes, and spurs, unencumbered by children. Nor indeed, during the entire 18 months that they had lived together, had she ever had that feeling. And so, what kind of a man was he then? What exactly was it that was missing, the absence of which made her feel so empty inside?
I know what it is, said Yelena to herself. There's no respect. You know, Seryozha, I don't respect you, she said gravely, raising her finger as she addressed the red bonnet.
And horrified at what she had just said, she shuddered at the thought that she was now on her own and wished that he were there with her. Even without that essential feeling of respect, she nonetheless wished he could have been with her at this difficult moment. He had gone, and her brothers had kissed him.
Did they have to do that? But what am I saying, for goodness sake? What could they have done? Stopped him from going? Of course not. Perhaps, in any case, it was better that he had gone at this difficult time, and that's fine. But on no account should they have stopped him from going. On no account. Let him go if he wants to. All right, they kissed him when he left, but deep inside they hate him, for heaven's sake. You lie and lie to yourself, but as soon as you start thinking about it, you realize they hate him. Nikolka is a kind person, but his elder brother... No, that's not quite right. Alyosha is also a kind person, but he just seems to hate him more. Lord, what am I saying? And Seryozha, what am I saying about you? What if we're cut off, with you having to stay there and me here? My husband, she said with a sigh, beginning to unbutton her housecoat. My husband.
The bonnet listened to this with interest, its cheeks suffused with a deep red color. And what kind of a man is your husband? It asked. He's simply a bastard. That's all there is to it, said Alexei Turbin to himself, alone in his room across the hallway from Yelena. He had similar thoughts to Yelena, and he had spent the last few minutes in torment. Yes, he's a bastard, but I'm a useless specimen. If I couldn't kick him out, I could at least have left the room without saying anything. But anyway, he can go to hell. He's not a bastard because he left Yelena at such a time. When all's said and done, that's just trivial rubbish. It's for quite another reason. But what then? I can see right through him, damn it. He's just a bloody puppet, lacking even the slightest concept of honor. Everything he says, whatever it is, makes him sound like a balalaika without any strings. And he's an officer, a graduate from a Russian military academy, supposed to be the finest that Russia can produce. The apartment fell silent. The strip of light emanating from Yelena's bedroom went dark. She had fallen asleep, unconscious to the world. But Alexei remained at his desk in his little room, tormented by his thoughts. The combination of vodka with German wine had disagreed with him. He sat there, looking at a page in the first book that had caught his attention, his inflamed eyes returning again and again to the same words. For a Russian, the concept of honor is merely an unnecessary burden. He got undressed and fell asleep only towards morning, and as he slept, his dream turned into a nightmare with the appearance of a little man wearing broad-checked trousers.
Best not sit on a hedgehog without any clothes, sneered the apparition. Holy Russia is a country that's wooden, poor, and dangerous. And for a Russian, the concept of honor is merely an unnecessary burden.
To hell with you, you contemptible little man, yelled Alexei in his sleep. And still dreaming, he fumbled around in his desk drawer for his revolver, pulled it out, and chased after the apparition, attempting to shoot it. Then it vanished, He slept for the next couple of hours, a black, turbid, dreamless sleep, and then, with the timid, pale light of dawn glimmering through the veranda windows, Alexei began to dream of the city.